Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com. Life is full of what ifs. Some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
All right, before we begin, you guys, it is that time, of course. I got to do some sponsor mentions, everybody. Gooder sunglasses, people. The season's approaching. Don't give the gift of a cheesy sweater. Give the gift of Gooder. Non-slipped, comfortable, and stylish on and off the bike. If you want to go full holiday mode, I guess, you know, you can go full holiday mode. Gooder can also accommodate your cheesy side with fun-themed frames. Also, go to Gooder.com today. Also, Ambassador Cycling. You know you've got to train over the winter, right? You know you want to actually remotely enjoy it, right? Well, a poor bike fit will not help. Go to it, ambassadorcycling.com today. Book some time with Bike Fit Sam. Your bike position is critical when on the trainer for hours at a time. Trust me. And finally, Athletic Brewing, people. You know, holidays can wreak havoc on your diet, right? Not to mention the extra dose of alcohol can definitely fuel some inappropriate conversations at the dinner table. So here's a tip. A little CBD to lighten the blow and Athletic Brewing to keep you focused and patient. Great flavor, non-alcohol. Use the Athletic Brewing link at Backfiller today. So let's do this. This is usually where I play the theme, but I don't like doing that when I have a caller on the line because I think it just might blast that caller out of there. So if the theme's being played right now, that means I put it in post and I actually edited a podcast for the first time. So this is where I go to the point where I say, well, it's happening. Thanksgiving is upon us. And we have a very special episode of the Pack Filler to distract you from those inevitable politically charged conversations that might pop up this week. Welcome to another episode of the Pack Filler. I am Pat Bulger in the under construction Pack Filler studio. We are at work on progress, but the shows must go on. Speaking of the show, we do indeed have a special episode here, so let's meet the panel with our special guest, a guest, of course, being saved for the last. So let's get to know them, shall we? Gentlemen, when I introduce you, please let us know your preferred Thanksgiving dessert, along with the tradition you hold special for the holiday. So first and foremost, welcome, of course, the Ed McMahon of the Pack Filler Podcast, Mr. Disc himself, Paul Main. How are you, man?
Disc.
Doing well, thanks. That's been a while.
Yeah, a week. It has. We took a week off. Yeah, exactly. So Thanksgiving dessert and tradition.
Usually after dinner, laying down on my back, feeling terrible.
Okay.
Yeah, dessert. I like Marionberry pie.
Marionberry.
Wow, yeah, that's not me. Yeah, I know. Yeah. But I'm having prime rib.
See, that's even more messed up. Man.
Because I only eat what I like. Yeah. And a lot of it.
All right. Second in the panel, Mr. Needs a New Road Bike, Jack Broadhead. How are you, man?
I'm good.
No new road bike yet?
Not yet. Nobody makes them.
Still cruising around on 1992.
Yep. It's 2010.
Okay. Favorite Thanksgiving dessert and tradition, Jack?
Apple pie and turkey trot.
Apple pie. Whoa.
Oh, yeah.
The turkey trot.
We'll start our day with a little activity.
Very nice. Third, Mr. Youth is Fleeting. Use it while you can. Jackson Bulger. How are you, man?
Doing well. I couldn't agree more with that. let's see. Favorite Thanksgiving dessert. We have been recently doing cherry pie. That's my favorite pie.
Okay.
Don't You're the
no, one.
I have I have dinner at your house. And then tradition. Man, I really, this is going to sound terrible. I really love the parade. I don't know what it is, but like, I love a good 15 minutes of the parade. I have nothing. Then after a while, it gets boring, and then you just, yeah, you just forget about it.
Sleep through the tryptophan.
Yep.
Very nice. All right, you guys. Our special guest is, boy, this is, I hope I get it all. I could go to the entire show with just his introduction. Founder and CEO of Carmichael Training Systems. He was a member of the 1984 U.S. Olympic cycling team, the 7-Eleven professional team, Schwinn Wheaties professional cycling team. His coaching positions are legendary, and the list of victories by CTS coach athletes are too long to mention. Author of multiple best-selling books and a true pioneer in the sport, and especially how it is approached. So let's welcome. And we had him on the show, I guess, boy, about a while ago. Yeah. Welcome back to the show, the one and only Chris Carmichael. How are you, sir?
I'm doing well, Pat. Appreciate you having me back on.
Yeah. So do you have a Thanksgiving dessert treat and tradition at all?
Yes, I do. Pecan pie. Absolutely my favorite Thanksgiving dessert with a nice big scoop of vanilla ice cream. And it's actually my favorite Christmas dessert as well. it's my favorite dessert any time. A nice homemade pecan pie with a scoop of vanilla ice cream. You heat up the pie, put the ice cream on top, it slowly melts, and yeah, there's nothing better in my
process
in my
to
book.
This.
As far as a tradition, you know, I think I like to ride my bike on Thanksgiving because I like to know I'm blowing through some calories so I can, you know, not feel too bad when I sit down and overindulge and eat as much as I can to where I have to lay down and just watch the rest of the football games on laying down on the couch or something, you know. But that's so I definitely try to get out and ride. I'm an outdoor rider. I'm not an indoor rider. Oh. And you know, it's just I don't have any problem with you know, the craze now of everybody on the various you know, indoor cycling platforms, but I like being outside and plus I'm old, so it's kind of hard to teach a old dog new tricks, so to speak.
Paul Main is beaming right now joy because he calls riding online chasing cartoons, and he only rides inside, and I guess if he's cuffed to the chain to the floor or something like that.
It.
But yeah. And I'm just glad we finally got somebody with a traditional Thanksgiving dessert to chime in. I mean, you guys, I'm embarrassed.
Pie?
I'm embarrassed. No, apple pie is not a traditional Thanksgiving pie.
That's 4th of July,
Jack. Oh. Me, I'm definitely pumpkin pie with enough whipped cream to cover the entire slice. And my tradition is I watch Christmas Vacation on Thanksgiving Day with the Chevy Chase movie. That's my tradition. So, first of all, I usually open all the shows with asking who's riding and everything like that. And I think pretty much the panel here has been off the bike quite a bit and
we've
everybody's
given up.
Nodding with me. Chris, I know that you say you're out there riding and stuff like that, but if I can mention it, you're actually staring down the barrel of a surgical process here soon.
Yes, unfortunately, I am. I broke my femur, my right leg. A long, long time ago, close to 40 years ago, and it was a really bad fracture, and I lost an inch in length in the femur when they put it back together, and I remember the doctor telling me that as I was finally leaving the hospital after about a month there that I'll have post-trauma arthritis in the knee. And I'm like, well, what's that? And he explained it. And I said, when's that going to happen? And he says, oh, probably when you're 60 or so, you'll probably need a knee replacement. And now 61, and about 3 months before I turned 60, I had pain in the knee for a long time, but like 3 months before it became pretty unbearable. And I was like, and I recalled that conversation. I was like, God, did that guy nail it? You know, are they that good that they can, you know, yeah, you know, 40 years later, you're going to have that thing replaced. So I've got to do a knee replacement, and I kind of put it off to the end of the cycling season, and with the thought I didn't want to do any rehab on it till you know, when the weather was nice out, let's do it when it's not. Yeah. And but unfortunately my left leg has been really sore and has gotten incredibly painful the last few months, and I went to see the orthopedic surgeon and he did an x-ray, and he says, look, you're bone on bone on that left hip, just like the right knee, so you got to get a hip replacement too. Wow. And I kind of thought that it was the left leg was just really sore because it was overcompensating for the right knee, you know, and being weaker. But I guess because of a multitude of reasons, you know, that is arthritic too, so I'm gonna get the hip done first because that's the most painful, and then I'll probably do the knee later in 2022. Like probably I'll get through the cycling season and then I'll do the knee replacement, and you know, right around now next year. At least that's what I'm thinking right now.
But you're still able to ride, which I think is the ultimate testimony to the beauty of the sport that we do. And I don't mean that to sound as overly cheesy and self-righteous as it is, but you know, for the runners in the room, hi Jack. It's just a better.
You're absolutely right, Pat. I actually feel much like I don't have pain when I ride, and well, I do. My knee hurts, but it's I can ride with it, you know. But you know, everything I can understand how people. Would get hooked on, you know, that whole opioid crisis because, you know, I lay in bed and my, you know, it hurts and just kind of sitting there, it hurts. And so I can understand that, but my bike is my church, you know, and that's where I go and I try to ride it and go to church every day. And I love to ride. I feel better on the bike and Bill Walton, you know, as many, you know, hardcore cyclists know, he's also a cyclist as well as being a, you know, great basketball player. He's had so many surgeries, and when you watch him walk, it's just painful to watch him. Oh. But he says the same thing when he gets on the bike is the only time during the day he's really pain free. Mm. And I kind of feel that same way.
Okay. I'm trying to digest so much what's just going on with what you just said, and I'm trying to go
ahead.
Well,
you're digesting. Yeah. How many miles a week do you ride,
Chris?
Yeah. Chris, I'm not talking to
you,
Pat. Yeah, sorry. How many miles a week do you ride?
I'm usually about an 8 to 10 hour. A week guy, I'll have 8,000 miles in by the end of the year. So, you know, I do still some camps. Like I leave, you know, unfortunately I got to go to Maui on Saturday for a week long training camp. And I know it's a tough job, but, you know, in that week I'll ride, probably 400 miles. And so, you know, I'm a lifer. I started bike racing in 1969. I was 9 years old, and I every day I'm on the bike, I'm happy. And so as much as I ride, it's hard. You know, I do like I'll do this camp in Maui and I'll probably put in 400 miles, but I'm normally probably a 150, you know, mile a week kind of guy 8 hours, 10 hours. In the summer, I'll push it up and do 10 to 12 hours probably.
Well, that gives me a perfect segue. Thank you, Jack. You helped me out, man. Oh. Because as Chris is here, one would automatically deduce that the topic is going to have to be do with coaching, training, and performance. And it is. And we will get to that. But as three quarters of the show are experienced enough to remember the glory of the 7-Eleven days, we must reminisce a bit. And you, Chris, you talked about starting cycling earlier and being a lifer. And I know you. This is a brutal ask, but if you had to provide a quick synopsis of those development years, how would you describe them?
Yeah, I was really fortunate because I grew up in South Florida, and there was a big influx of Cubans from Cuba in the early 60s, and cycling was a popular sport in Cuba. So there was the Cuban population down there had a really strong infrastructure for cycling. I would do races just about every Sunday in the 10 to 12 age group, and it'd be 30 or 40 kids out there in that age group, and just about every Sunday. So really, really fortunate. There were only two types of riding. There was, two types of cycling. There was road and there was track, and that was at that time. And there was no gravel, although we rode our bikes on a ton of gravel roads. we just didn't call them gravel, but I guess we were ahead of our time. But I'm really fortunate because I feel like that early period helped shape me and helped shape my coaching and what would be acceptable versus if I grew up in, Des Moines, Iowa or something and wanted to be a bike racer. I'm not taking a swipe at Iowa or anything, but it just in the late 60s, early 70s, cycling was not very advanced in the U.S.
Sure. And your development came across, through your junior years, which were pretty exceptional as terms of cycling development would go, and then you actually raced as an amateur for a Dutch team, Gazelle, correct?
I did. I lived in Holland and Belgium for, from about 19 to 20. 23 most of the cycling season. I'd come back and forth.
Sure.
But I rode for the Gazelle team. I rode for a couple other Dutch and Belgium club teams. And it was at that point, cycling was not a global sport. It was really a European sport. And even somewhat, when I say European, it was not really... It was mainly in Belgium, France, Italy, Holland, a little bit of Spain, a little bit of Germany, but those were the big countries for cycling and, a little bit of Britain, but really France, Belgium, Italy, Holland, those were where everything was happening.
So developing, and guys, jump in whenever you want. Just raise your hand or something like that. Those. I don't mean to fast forward through such legendary years, but those years with 7-Eleven, incredibly groundbreaking for the listeners out there who, if you weren't involved in the sport in those years, when 7-Eleven came to prominence after the Olympics, the entire team turned professional and decided just, what the hell, let's conquer, let's try our first Tour de France, and just things that happened that and I don't want to go all hyperbole here in terms of blowing things out of proportion, but they were groundbreaking years in what you guys did and how you guys presented yourselves to the European peloton. Was there any knowledge at the time of what you guys were doing and how you guys were potentially changing the landscape of the sport itself?
No, not at all, really. And I think really it, at the time, we just, you know, we that's where the best bike racing in the world was, and we just wanted to measure ourselves against the best, and we really didn't know what we were doing. We didn't have a lot of guidance. We did have, you know, Mike Neal was our sports director, and he raced in Italy. He raced the Vuelta and finished, I think, 10th in the Pro Worlds one year. And Jim Okowitz was the team owner and general manager, and he had a big racing career too. We just, you know, I think if you really think you're doing something groundbreaking when you're doing it, it doesn't really work. It has to be, I think, in a certain way more authentic, you know. Yeah. It just has to be like, you just don't know, you're just out there just doing what you love to do versus thinking you're doing something that is that, you know, people will look back on now 35 years, 40 years later and go, wow, that was, you know, extraordinary. At the time, we didn't feel all that extraordinary, and nor did, you know, we were pretty nervous about being in the pro peloton. And I think that's what, one of the things that made it special and makes it unique is that authenticity kind of comes through with the team. You know, it wasn't like we were this highly polished, well orchestrated group of guys. We just wanted to get out there and, you know, race against the best.
Yeah. I sometimes overuse this cliche. Was it lightning in a bottle, so to speak? Was it just something that happened and could potentially never happen again? I mean, just the right people at the right time at the right place? Or am I again blowing things out of proportion?
Well, I don't know. You know, I think we're all very close still. You know, we have a reunion every 5 years where we all get together. Unfortunately, COVID kind of thwarted that last year. And,
sure.
And, you know, I like to think so. And, you know, now 40 years later, you look back and you reminisce and it feels that way. But, you know, I know at the time, you know, I remember pulling back, having to pull with Bob Roll and Alex Vita, and when, you know, Andy Hampson was in the leader's jersey in the Tour of Switzerland, trying to chase a break for 100 miles, like just flat out team time trial. I remember I hated Andy. You know, you've been in that break, you know, and he's like, why did you not just go with it? And at the time, you know, now you look back and go, oh, wasn't that really cool? You know, I say that I hated him, not really, but you know, we had a lot of disagreements, arguments, a lot of great times, you know, a lot of hugs and tears and, you know, and everything else. But like I said, it's easy to kind of look back and go, oh, it's this really special time and this unique group of guys and everything. And maybe, but you know, it seems like there's, hopefully there's more of those. 'Cause I know like there's other teams, like cycling teams, like the CRC of A team, you know, sponsored by Raleigh. Those guys are pretty tight. Yeah. And they were sort of, you know, early in the development of US cycling and they raced mainly in the US. It was just a unique time period in cycling. There was not the same pressures of social media and everything where you now, you know, race results don't even matter. It's how many followers you have, which yeah. I still can't quite comprehend that, but, it was just a unique time period. I'm glad that I grew up racing then and not now.
So to transition into your coaching career, almost immediately after your retirement. Was that a plan all along?
No. It was, you know, kind of like most things in cycling. When I hear people's stories, like I was at the U.S. Bicycling Hall of Fame dinner induction, was just a few weeks ago here in Colorado Springs, and I went to that and listened to all these, you know, incredible athletes that were being inducted in the Hall of Fame. And the one thing that was like the same, you know, that they all shared was that it was really just by dumb luck that they got into cycling, you know, like there was no sort of like grand plan or like they were part of the Nike Junior Racing, you know, and some high school league, and then, you know, went up and they, you know, they were in this kind of pipeline that scooted them up. There was all just like, yeah, I somehow borrowed my brother's bike and I loved it, and I, you know, and all of a sudden won a race, and you know, but it was all just and you know, same thing for us. It just felt like a little bit of dumb luck, you know.
Yeah. So and to the creation of this program, was it incredible? Was a giant step, something kind of not heard of at the time. Sure, the internet was available, but not.
Well, thank you. We, you know, the one thing that I, when I was an athlete, I remember being on the national team, and Eddie B was a huge influence on most of us in that generation, and he was a very good coach. And you know, I mean, there was like every coach, there's pluses and minuses, but I, you know, if you look at the athletes that he developed and played a role in their development, they'll all, you know, raise their hand and say, yeah, Eddie was a great influence and great coach for them. And I believe the same, but you know, it was, outside of that, the coaches that were in cycling, they were just basically warm bodies, you know. And if you were on a national trip and you, it was, you know, 2 o'clock in the morning, you were had diarrhea or throwing up, and you'd go to the coach's room, knock on the door, they wouldn't be there. They'd be at the bar, you know. And so, you know, I vowed when I got into the national team program coaching that I wanted to make sure that no athletes experience that same sort of thing when I was there. And so I brought a lot of sports science into our programs. I got a lot of exercise physiologists hired and engaged. I got aerodynamic specialists, biomechanists, and we were kind of on the cusp of an explosion of science and cycling, and a lot of the kind of best practices that are in use today were pioneered back from the mid 90s when I was at U.S. Cycling. And some of the, you know, great sports scientists we had in the program, Dr. Ed Burke, who unfortunately passed away quite a few years ago, but he was involved. He was involved in Eddie's team in 1984, and we got a lot of other sports scientists, exercise physiologists involved, and they brought so much science into our cycling program that still lives on today, which is kind of cool.
Your list of clients, from Lance to Katarina Nash, Dean Karnazes, how do you approach athletes of such calibers? Well, many of us on the outside would think that these highly, you know, professional athletes, they know what to do. They know how to approach their careers, and they know, you know, oh, I got this, you know, I'm just going to do what my job is. But there's so much more detail that goes into it. How do you approach these incredibly elite athletes who come to you saying, I need that extra edge, I need those types of performance benefits?
Sure. Some of the elite athletes I worked with very early in their career while they were kind of emerging elite, you know, and from Bobby Julich to Lance Armstrong, George Hincapie, and at that time they were just kind of the best juniors advancing into to the next level up to the senior ranks. And so it was somewhat easier because they had not achieved the levels that they did in the sport. So in that way it was really easy to get embedded in sort of their lives, their cycling lives. And that's what you needed to do, because I remember taking these guys to Mountain Chalet here in Colorado Springs and getting them, you know, winter gloves and booties and things like that, that they're like, well, we're going to Italy to race and it's March, won't it be warm? It's like, no, it's going to be cold, trust me. And they had no idea. And just kind of getting, the first step is the sort of trying to get them embedded in the culture and not always looking to like, okay, how much longer? You know, I got 3 more stage races and then we go back to the U.S. I can't wait to get back. It's like, no, you have to look at it differently. You have to look at, this is where you are right now. This is where you live right now. You need to adapt to this environment. And adaption is really the key to success in any sport. You know, the best athletes, they adapt the quickest. They get the greatest benefits from the training, the greatest adaptation benefits. They also adapt to the environment that they're in. There's the ones that are really good. You could take them to, you go from Texas to France, to Italy, to Japan, to Russia to race, and it didn't matter. It's like, hey, I'm here to race a bike, you know, and I plan to be the best out there. And that's the way they approach it. It's kind of a mindset, you know, and adaption is key. It's not just adapting physiologically. It's also adapting to the cultural changes that you have, the weather conditions. I mean, there's all, you can find all the reasons in the world why an athlete can't perform well. They can, but the ones that really go on and do things great are the ones like, hey, I'm a bike racer. I'm going to race in Colorado. I'm going to race in France. I'm going to race in Germany. I'm going to race in Japan. I'm going to race in Colombia. I don't care that I'm going to be on the start line and you're going to have to go through me to win. And that's adapting. And the best are the ones that adapt physiologically, psychologically, you know, and sort of that cultural adaptation to like, you know what, it's a little different now in Europe, but in the middle of the day, everything used to shut down.
Yeah.
And it still does in some places, but it's become much more like the U.S. But in the 90s, and it was like, wait a second, we can't go out and go grocery shopping. It's 1 o'clock in the afternoon. No, it's going to open back up at 4. So just wait.
Yeah.
So I think something that really kind of piqued my interest when you were talking about it was you mentioned the kind of the emphasis on an aerodynamics coach. And that's something that as of recent I've noticed is kind of trending upwards, just aerodynamics in general. Could you kind of like expand on that part of the coaching regimen? Because that's something that, like I said, really, really interests me a lot.
Sure. I mean, especially for the two major resistances that you have to overcome in cycling is gravity. So obviously when we go uphill, it gets harder, tends to be more of a small person sport because if you can produce the power and you weigh a little less, you know, your power to weight's higher. The next is wind resistance, you know, the size of hole that you push through the air, that's resistance. And so it is now There's all kinds of new software that allows you to really analyze an athlete on the bike in different positions that you really you used to have to go to the wind tunnel and spend tons of time, and some of it was much more of a static type of environment in a wind tunnel. So you really sometimes you weren't sure from a biomechanical standpoint it was going to work, that position was going to work well for the athlete. So a lot of the times what we'd have to do is also do we'd use a power meter on the velodrome and kind of hone the position from the wind tunnel to the athlete doing a very prescribed type of workout, and look at the power at these different speeds and see if the power starting to drop, or they, you know, more aerodynamic and also biomechanically effective as well. Now with so many of these software apps out there, you can really bypass all that and get some great aerodynamic position. If you're a time trialist or you're doing triathlon, aerodynamics, it's important for everybody, but that if you're just a big guy who produces a lot of power, but you're not looking at your position on the bike and trying to optimize your position for better aerodynamics, you're going to lose for sure.
Well, I just got depressed, but Paul has a question.
Yeah, just to follow up, Chris. Sure. Kind of our talk a little bit is the industry, the bike industry lately have been focusing so much on aerodynamics on the bike. And I've heard, and you could verify too, that 90% of the wind drag is usually your position or the rider themselves and not the bike. My frustration with the bike industry is they're not focusing on the right
Pat,
position.
Can you repeat that? I didn't hear him very well.
Oh, no. Yeah, he's...
I'll repeat it here. Yeah. So the bike industry, we've been complaining about making these aerodynamic bikes. They're so expensive that, you know, somebody getting started into cycling can't afford a $10,000 bike. You know, it's all this aerodynamics seems to be focused. The industry is focusing on these bikes that are low drag. Well, my take on it is like 90% of the drag is the person in the position. And I don't know if you could like agree with that, or you think the bike is a big part of it. But go ahead.
I'm sorry, you. I kept hearing like every couple words.
Oh shoot!
So,
yeah.
Yeah, I'm sorry about that.
No, not a problem. Maybe I can fill in. Hopefully, I can. I don't know if one mic is working better than the other, but he's just in terms of the bike industry focusing so heavily upon aerodynamics versus rider aerodynamics. Is there, do you have any thoughts in terms of one versus the other and the importance of rider aerodynamics over bike aerodynamics?
Yeah.
Do okay, Paul?
You know, I mean, the greatest drag is the person on the bike. The greatest aerodynamic drag is the person on the bike. So your position amounts for about 95% of the aerodynamic drag, of the total aerodynamic drag. It's about 95%. So optimizing the position and not even doing anything to the bike, you know, optimizing your position so you can reduce your aerodynamic drag is absolutely where you're going to get the greatest gains. Absolutely, you know. You know, we all like the new shiny, you know, newest thing, like, you know, oh, this helmet has no vents, and oh, this helmet has a ton of vents, and, you know, it just depends upon the year that all these things come out. But when you can have the fastest bike, and fastest meaning the one that has the least aerodynamic drag, and put somebody on that bike and just plop them on there without really, you know, just sort of doing a normal type of fit with them, and then you can put somebody on that same bike and optimize their fit for aerodynamics. That person who has an optimized fit for aerodynamics will generally have a better performance than that, if everything else physiologically is relatively the same, versus the person who just, you know, you just had a standard fit on it, you know, because once again, it's the person on the bike and the mass of the person that creates the greatest aerodynamic drag. So you really need to optimize the position as best you can. Now, you know, I always like to look at bike fit. There's three things you should be considering. One is aerodynamics. One is biomechanics or power production. Probably a better term. And the other is comfort. You know, and those three: comfort, aerodynamics, and power production. If you lean towards anyone, if you go to more comfort, you're making sacrifices in aerodynamics and power production. If you go more towards power production, well, your aerodynamics and comfort will start to be sacrificed. So as you, it's that balance between all three and trying to optimize it, and with each person too. And some athletes here naturally can achieve a very aerodynamic position, and also they're have no problem with power production in a very aerodynamic position. Others, you know, they can get to the aerodynamic position, but they can't produce the power.
Yeah.
And you can manipulate that by some flexibility and some, there's some things that you can do, but it ultimately you're going between those three points of comfort, aerodynamics, and power production.
Does that help, Paul?
I mean,
you feel better because I know you've been big about aerodynamics, and that is a big
that
thing for you.
Describes his position too.
Yeah, it does describe his position.
He is aero.
Yeah,
and power.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's a reflection on. It frustrates me that the bike industry is selling a product that's would help, you know, the elite, and yeah. not the start. Those, I mean, everybody wants an aero bike now.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
So. And yeah, now it costs you $8,000, $10,000. And who can start, you know, racing with that?
You know, but what's funny, Paul, is if you just hit replay and you go back to the kind of the late, I wouldn't say late, like kind of mid-80s, Shimano did a big push in aerodynamics for bikes. You know, for like some of their, a lot of their components, they came out. I think it was
the DA.
Something was the.
It was the DA aero shifters.
And you know, and they had a rear derailleur that was had, you know, these aerodynamic, you know, kind of configuration to it to cover as much of the pulleys where there would be turbulence from the derailleur pulleys you know, and the crank arm and the brakes, they went to a center pole brake versus side pole brake, which at that time was most popular because that was a little more aerodynamic. So it, like most of these things, it just seems like every 10 years, 15 years, they start coming back and the bike industry is pushing aerodynamics right now. They're obviously pushing gravel and technology also is what driving new athletes, people coming into our sport. But sometimes it can be a little, for somebody who's been in the sport for a while, sometimes it can look a little ridiculous, you know, like I see some of these guys that just bought a big, you know, gravel bike and they're riding on a, you know, the green path here in Colorado Springs. That's basically it's a bike path, you know, and it's not paved, but it's kind of like just kitty litter, really it's just like hard packed. It's fine, and I'll see people riding on like 42, tires, and they'll ride with these big suede bars because they got to do that because they're on gravel, And it's like, oh my gosh, it's just a little. Sometimes it seems a little over the top, but because I just look at it and go, wow, I'm. A lot of the times when I ride on a gravel road, I'll just be on my road bike.
That to Paul should be beaming right now. So talk to me about the mortals. We talked about some of the elite athletes that you've coached and those types of really high-end performers. There are some of us out there, even some might be in this very studio, that don't work with a coach and don't understand maybe the value of such a relationship or a service. Can you give me some insight into the importance of working with a coach and what kind of levels per se that are available for, for guys like us who've been doing it for life and think we know that, the Eddie B platform of Monday off, Tuesday sprints, Wednesday distance, Thursday intervals, those types of things. Talk to me about how you approach some of those old curmudgeon assholes or something like that.
Sure. I think now people really it's come to the point that most people have a pretty good idea of what they're going to get when they sign up for coaching. When I started CTS nearly 22 years ago, it was kind of like, well, what do we get? How's this going to help me? But now coaching is, not just CTS, but there's many other coaching companies, coaches. So, I think the thing that I see is, in the coaching industry, there's so much science that's coming into our sport, and that is that's benefiting us a lot. But that's not coaching. You want to make sure your coaching's founded in good, solid sport science. But that is just all the things. Science is based upon all the knowns, the things that we know, and that's great. And that's very important for developing a good training program and manipulating the training on a daily basis. But coaching is really about all the things that are unknown, and it's taking and things that are just kind of gut feels, experiences, working with the individual, motivating the individual, inspiring them, and being there when it's not going well, because that's ultimately when the coach has the greatest value, I believe, is when it's not going well. And it's not, for even the best athletes in the world, it's not a perfect ascending curve where you just get better and better and better. It's a series of, step ups, plateaus, periods of injury, setbacks, all kinds of things. And that's when you need the relationship, and you need to know that you can count on somebody who knows you well, and you can be, you can kind of bare your soul and be brutally honest with them, and vice versa, and it's really in those unknowns where it's those interpersonal skills, that's really where the art of coaching comes in.
It almost sounds like it's an improvisational relationship where you're dealing with a set program, you're building somebody something, and then when these problems or injuries or whatever might come into their lives, heaven forbid a global pandemic, the coach really has to be able to think on his or her feet and adapt according to what might be going on within the athlete's life.
Absolutely. And you have to, it's just, each athlete's different, what motivates one is a disincentive for the other. And, some need,
it's therapy,
it's
psychology
sure. It is, but it's intertwined in their activity. It's intertwined in what they're engaged with, which is training and racing. And there's athletes that perpetually always under deliver and they have the physiology, they have the gifts, they have everything. They do the work. They more than do the work, and you know they're always under delivering on their performances when it comes to their race.
Yeah.
There's athletes who always over deliver. You know, like you know they've kind of so it's and so you have to ask yourself, how do you work with each one of these? Because these each you know they all want coaching. And so that's where that art of coaching comes into play.
I remember the Time Crunch Cyclist. I remember buying that book. And I think that was about the time that you and I had our first talk on the show and how it changed my perspective. I said earlier that I grew up on the Eddie B. Greg LeMond plan, you know, which was a lot of that kind of stuff, base miles, and then you build speed work on top of it and those types of things. That book changed that to a great degree. So I'd like to ask you about, first of all, the research that went into that book and how you approach athletes, like a lot of people who listen to this show, who work for a living, who have families, who do all these types of things, and how they can approach the sport on a realistic timetable and still be able to accomplish some of the things they're striving for.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Well, let me first say that getting in, you know, great base miles or what we call foundation miles, there's a lot of value from a physiological standpoint that really can't be replaced and it needs to be there. But and here's the big but, is most of us don't have the time to be able to do that. Yeah. And sure, that's easy if you're paid to race your bike. And then, you know, you can go out and do 5, 6, 7 hours, you know, 5, 6 days a week. Sure, that's great. But most of us struggle to get in 8 hours on the bike in a week. And, you know, you get a good 2-hour, 3-hour ride in on one of the weekend days. And then you're trying to fill in from there with maybe Tuesday and Thursday you get out, and maybe a bit on Friday, and so it's doing foundation miles at that low intensity level for that short a period of time, you know, that short a duration of doing, let's say, just a 2-hour ride, riding at a easy to moderate pace. There's not going to be enough training stress to get a physiological adaptation from that. And if you made it 4, 5, 6 hours, now it obviously depends upon the athlete's level.
Sure.
You know, if they're just starting off versus, you know, more conditioned. But for most of us who are an avid cyclist, we're riding, you know, between 6 and 10 hours a week. So getting in a 2-hour base ride, that's not enough to give you what the physiological adaptations you would want to see occur, the changes in the mitochondria and things like that. That's just not enough training load. So we, you know, kind of flipped it on its head and said, listen, if you are what we call a time crunch cyclist, somebody who has 6 to 10 hours a week to train, then why do base miles? Why not do something that's going to improve your VO2 max or your power at lactate threshold? Doing base miles to get you know, better fuel utilization, changes in the mitochondria, things like that to occur in a 2-hour ride. Yeah, maybe if you were able to do a 4, 5, 6-hour ride and do that, you know, where you're doing 15 to 25 hours a week for weeks at a time, yes, you'll get those changes. You'll get those adaptations. But most of us don't have the time. So let's focus on improving our VO2 max, and let's focus on improving our power at your lactate threshold. And if we do that, you'll perform better. Flat out, you'll ride faster. You'll be more comfortable and more efficient. Now, you'll have some limitations, longer events. You know, if you're doing a 100-mile race, yeah, you're going to be definitely out of your comfort zone.
Yeah.
But if you've improved your VO2 max and your power at lactate threshold's higher, you'll perform better than somebody who's doing a lot of 100-mile rides who never stresses those energy systems.
It's a painful training plan. I'm not going to lie. It is something where you're really putting your stress in yourself. But and you emphasize in the book the importance of focusing on timelines and planning ahead and doing this in a cyclical process.
Yeah, exactly. It is, but recovery is also there's. That's the only way you adapt. That's the only way you get faster or stronger is during the recovery period, not while you're training hard. It's during the recovery period. So the other good reason for this training is if you have a power meter and you can upload that to Training Peaks or you know, a lot of other softwares out there, you can clearly see in those intervals, because it's not like when you look at a 6-hour foundation base miles ride, it's just a, you know, moderate easy ride. You're not going to see those adaptations in your training file, but improving your VO2 max or your power at threshold, very easy to break down those files and look at those intervals and see, are you continuing to adapt? Are you starting to flatten out? Do you need to get more of a recovery cycle in? Very easy to manipulate your training basically on a daily basis after those workouts. Like, okay, I can keep doing, oh, I should increase the duration of these intervals versus increasing the power. I should increase the power and shorten the duration of those intervals. Very easy to come to those conclusions by looking at those power files versus, oh, I'm doing foundation miles. What are you looking for to see if that person's adapting in that power file? Not as easy to identify by any means.
Well, it's good to know that there's something like that out there, because I'm coming recently off of, you know, being in college. You got all the time in the world, especially in COVID, not to be, you know, thankful for a pandemic or anything, for Christ's sake, but I had all that time in the world, and now I'm moving into that 9-to-5, or in my case, 7:30 to 8:40-ish job. And so it's good to know that there's something like this out there for people who don't necessarily know how to get into the routine of being an adult.
There you go. Yeah.
So, but before we kind of, you know, guys, again, please feel free to chime in. And but I kind of want to, and this topic alone could be like 30 episodes or 12 books, talking about the issue of diet. We're staring down the barrel of Thanksgiving ahead. And I've said on the show many a times, making sure I lose and try to maintain some sort of riding weight is something that's really important to me. So I guess I kind of want to ask a kind of a twofold question. So what are some of the mistakes that cyclists tend to make in terms of their diet? And my second one was, how about some of those fads such as intermittent fasting that come up and are, you know, a lot of people are trying to find quick and easy ways to maintain or to lose excess weight?
Well, generally with cyclists, everybody gets sort of obsessed with weight at certain periods when you're in your cycling career, and the truth is, if the lighter you can get and still maintain your power, yeah, that helps a lot in your performance, not just obviously on climbs and the hills, but also in heat, also in acceleration, as long as you're maintaining that power. So, for a lot of cycling events, even events on the flat, it's a series of, you know, small accelerations, sometimes bigger accelerations, but the lighter you are, the quicker you're going to be able to accelerate, at least initially, you know. And so being light is helpful. But also recognizing that it's also about making sure you're healthy too. And that there is no quick and easy answer. There are things. Intermittent fasting has shown that there are some benefits of it, but I tend to look at the long game on it. And anytime you're following a fad or a diet or anything like that, it's just it's short lived, and it's just exactly that. It's a diet. Why not get on eating a healthy and making sure that you know eating, and what I mean by that is making sure you're eating as clean as you can with good healthy fats, proteins, are obviously carbohydrates. We need carbohydrates, but not filling it with, you know, the easy quick carbohydrates, but the whole grains, the pastas and things like that, that's great. And but you've got to realize that jumping on these fads, you won't make it. If you're, it's going to be for a little bit, and then you'll pop. Most professional cyclists, it sounds like there's a big tendency saying now there's a big emphasis on weight. There's always been an emphasis on weight.
Yeah.
If you looked at Greg LeMond February, and you looked at Greg LeMond in July, he was 25 pounds lighter.
Half the person.
You know? Same thing with Hino. Same thing with Fignon. You know, there's always been an emphasis. And so I think it might... Now we have more ways to measure it, so more ways in which to get as lean as possible and maintain the power output. But usually that's a relatively short period of time that a cyclist gets like that, you know, and then they put a little more extra weight back on and they're doing fine.
Should I ask about alcohol in a cyclist diet, or should I just blow it off?
Well, you know, it's bringing, that's one of the things when you asked about what are some of the quick fixes is, you know, you're getting a lot of calories whenever you're having a glass of wine or beer. You know, we tend to drink, beer usually has less calories than wine. We drink less wine though, but it's still, a glass of wine is generally about 90 calories, you know? And yeah. So do you stop on one glass of wine, or does one become two and sometimes three? And you're just taking in calories that are not, there's no benefit at all.
Yeah.
And, it's impairing probably your sleep cycles as well. So it's kind of what I say is get rid of the nutrition clutter, cut out the, alcohol, cut out the kind of processed carbohydrates, the desserts, things like that, cut that stuff out. Any types of sodas or anything like that, start to eliminate some of the easy fat that you can eliminate, putting butter on your bread, things like that. You'll drop 10 pounds really quick. And most people, the problem is that nutritional clutter is what tastes so good.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's not, you know, that's why we all like it, right? And so it's not easy to cut out. You can cut it out for a little bit, but it's hard to keep it off.
Who was the pro team this year during the tour? Was it DSM that was monitoring their intake of calories during the stage to determine what went in the feed bag and what they ate for dinner afterwards?
Really?
Was that? I think it was.
I think it was DSM.
Yeah.
I don't know, Yumbo.
Yeah, they've
that's extreme.
So
I mean, that during a grand tour, it just doesn't seem like it yeah. would be a factor. I could see during training up to the grand tour, but not like limiting a guy that's just completed a 100-mile stage.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is the monitoring of the athletes from, you know, nutrition to to so many things, and they're optimizing this now well beyond that, you know, what was previously thought, because you basically, if you don't have a way to measure it, it's hard to make real changes. It's all based upon experiential sort of aspects. But there's so many different biometrics that we're measuring now. And so now that you're able to change them, measure it, you can manipulate it to get, sure. you know, a different measurement. So it's just normal that it's like, you know, if you look at the positions, look at the bars now. Everybody's going to these narrow bars. They're doing it on the track. They're doing it on doing it on the road now. Just the bars have gotten so narrow. You think back to Eddie Merckx, and you know it was like Cinelli Champion del Mundo's 44s, big wide bars, and that was the thought. You need the wide bars for the leverage and everything. But you look at how they've narrowed up the handlebars. There's so many different measurements that are now occurring. Now that you can measure things, then you can start manipulating them on a scientific basis and see whether you're getting improvements or not.
There's so much more to measure now. It's how many more things to think about. Guys, before I get to the fun final section of the show, is there anything I didn't touch upon that you guys wanted to jump in and ask Chris before we go to the silly fun final part?
I get something that did kind of interest me is when we were talking about the early 7-Eleven days. So like going to those first, the tours, you know, we talk a lot about like the hierarchy of the peloton of what it used to be. What was it like kind of entering into those spaces? Was it like, oh, who are these American guys? Or it's like, what was that atmosphere like in the beginning?
The atmosphere, you know, it was, we were scared. I don't know. Like at the beginning, everybody was just nervous. We didn't want to be the weirdos that were, caused any problems, because there weren't other Americans there. There was a few Brits and smatterings of a few Australians, and that was about it. And so we looked up to these guys, and you know, like Francisco Moser and Bernard Hinault and Laurent Fignon, and we just didn't want to knock one of them over, you know, I just remember that we also wanted to win, you know, and that was clear, because every race, it was like, how could we win this race? That's what we talked about at the team. We had our meetings, usually in the morning, before the stage, and Mike Neal, the director, always liked to do that because he didn't want people getting nervous about the next day's stage when they're wrapped up for the day. So we always talked about how could we win this stage or this race, whether we really had anybody. Many times we'd say, well, we don't have a way, you know, we're not going to have, you know, but other times we knew we did. And that's, you know, we started from that point back. How could we win?
Wow. Okay. Well, first of all, before I even get to the fun part, Chris, tell me what listeners do. What somebody who's sitting there trying to get through their Thanksgiving dinner escapes the family for a few minutes to listen to this show. How do they? Where do they go? Where do they start? Where do they get this concept? Do they buy one of your books? Do they contact CTS directly? Where do they go if they're thinking, you know what? I'm enough of this screwing around. I want to get a coach and I want to get to the next level.
Sure. Website trainright.com. That's trainright.com. And just that's the best place to start.
Great. For
obviously that's my company and
sure.
We have 1-800 number there you can call and talk to our athlete service manager, and we'd be happy to explain what we do. We also have a new membership plan that's $20 a month, and you have a bunch of over 800 workouts to choose from and videos and all sorts of cool things like that. Nutrition tips. We have where you can post a question to the coach and the coach will answer it. So
brilliant.
That's our new TrainRight membership, which is there too.
Awesome. Okay. Well, let's have some fun. My panel, gentlemen, you've hopefully got to know Chris over the time. Now, a lot of you guys have, you know, we've all been dealing with his career for this far, and we've all, you know, been interested in everything that's going on. So our fun final game that we like to entertain our listeners with beyond the incredible content we provided in the show was what I call What Would Chris Say? So we're going to do this, and I'm going to ask each member of the panel quickly to say what they think Chris Carmichael would respond to, how he would respond to in these following questions. And you guys get to keep track of your own points. And you guys get to figure out who wins the game of understanding the mind of Chris Carmichael best. Okay? So, and then what we'll do is we'll go Paul, Jack, Jackson, and then Chris can say truly his opinions on that specific matter. And Chris is the only one that gets to expand on his thought process because he's the guest. All right. So first and foremost, gentlemen, what would Chris Carmichael say on aero bars on gravel bike? Yes, no, or hell no? Paul Main, what would Chris say?
I would say yes.
Yes, he would say yes. Jack Broadhead, what would Chris Carmichael say?
Hell no.
Hell no. Jackson Bulger.
I'm going to go with, this is a tough one, mm-hmm. I'm going to say yes.
You're going to say yes. Chris, aero bars on gravel bikes, your opinion, yes, no, or hell no?
Yes.
Oh, we got a yes on that one. All right, so we got the points on the board. The greatest of all time, greatest cyclist of all time. Who would Chris Carmichael choose as the greatest cyclist of all time? Paul Main.
Eddie Merckx.
Jack Broadhead.
I would say Eddie Merckx.
Eddie Merckx. Jackson Bulger.
The cannibal himself.
Mm-hmm. Eddie Merckx. Okay, we got three Eddie Merckxes, Chris. Yes or no?
Yeah, there's nobody else. Merckx. You know, I mean, it's like... That's a softball.
Okay, yeah. Sorry. I didn't know if we were going to play off into the left field or something like that. Okay, and this is one that, you know, and I'm going to just throw it out there. Let Lance Armstrong keep his Tour de France wins. Yes or no? Paul Main.
Yes.
Absolutely,
Jack
yes.
Jack Broadhead says yes. Mm-hmm. Jackson Bulger says yes. Chris?
Well, I would say yes. I'm obviously a bit biased.
Yeah.
You know, it's just the contradiction of that is kind of mind-boggling when you have, you know, Bjarne Riis who mm-hmm. raised his hand and
yeah.
said, yeah, I was
Jan Ulrich.
EPO mm-hmm. during the race. And, yeah. and you know, and Jan from the, you know, the following year and many others. It just, it, unfortunately, that was yet a game-changing drug with basically 10 years of really no way to be able to detect mm-hmm. it. And so it changed the sport, unfortunately. Yeah. And, you know, Lance earned those victories, in my view. He was the best, definitely the best bike racer out there for those 7 years, and I think he should have those victories.
Agreed. Mm-hmm. All right. The greatest team kit ever created in terms of appearance, in terms of looks, in terms of style. I mean, Paul Main, hopefully you got this. I'm throwing at you quickly. Paul
well,
Main.
Based on his time period, I would say Lave Claire, since
Lave
he had
Claire.
To face
okay.
those guys. Yeah.
Jack Broadhead.
Mm-hmm. God. I know I'm supposed to be quick. Panasonic.
Panasonic. Jackson Bulger. This is hard for you. I understand. You can go modern, too.
I was born.
Well, I was going to say the 7-Eleven kit.
7-Eleven kit.
Oh, that was good. Mm-hmm.
Chris Carmichael, greatest kit ever designed.
That's a good question. I think, you know, that old Bianchi jersey.
Yeah,
you know,
that's pretty.
That
that's pretty.
Fascio copy.
You know, Jamundi.
Yeah.
You know, it just that was a beautiful. It's super old school, but I still think that's super cool.
That's a great choice. And even when Jan Ulrich wore it, they did that remake of it, and that was still a gorgeous kit. Cool. That was still a gorgeous kit.
Exactly.
Yeah. It's a color that's hard to beat.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, it's timeless color.
Yeah. And it's patented. I think Bianchi owns that.
Yeah, that's number five, right?
Yeah, yeah. All right. Bernardino or Greg LeMond should have won the 1986 Tour. Who would Chris pick in terms of LeMond or Bernardino? Paul Main.
LeMond.
I would say LeMond.
This is 86.
Yeah, 86.
Okay.
Yeah.
Jackson, you probably have no idea what's going on, but you can pick
I'm going to go with the panel so I don't lose a point.
So go with the panel. Chris, who should have won the 1986 Tour?
Well, the guy who won it, Greg LeMond.
Okay.
Man, that's a pretty easy one.
Those battles that were just so intense. And was it the 85 Tour where, you know, had the crash and that was where the gigantic battle back and forth became, that should LeMond have been able to go ahead and those types of things? You got a theory on that one? The 85?
You know, I that's actually a really – that's another good question. You know, Greg, I'm surprised Greg held back. I think he could have won the 85 tour for sure. I'm surprised he held back, and I'm even I still kind of have a hard time believing, you know, Greg didn't really know going into 86. It's like, wait, the guy's won five tours. Nobody's won more than five tours. This is going to be his last year. Is he really going to work for me? And, you know, are you really not? It's like, I think that was doomed before it even got to the start line of the tour. I mean, it's like, look, you know, he was going to ride his own race regardless.
Yeah.
And Greg was the better bike racer and coming up, you know, I mean, you know, was at the end of his career. Greg was just at the really kind of the beginning and, you know, he was a damn good bike racer. That's for sure.
Yeah. All right, I got four questions left. This next one. Steel is steel real? Yes or no? Is steel still real with Chris Carmichael, Paul Main?
I'll say yes.
Yes, Jack.
Technology. No.
No, Jackson Bulger.
I think yes.
Okay. Chris is still real.
Well, I love a steel bike, so I'll say still real. I ride a carbon bike. I ride a wonderful carbon Canyon Ultimate, and it's awesome. But you know, I grew up on racing steel bikes, so I have fond memories of them.
All right, we're getting down there. The UCI's involvement in gravel. Yes, no, or hell no. Paul Main.
I say yes.
Paul says yes. Jack Broadhead.
I say hell no. I'm going down.
Hell no. Jackson Bulger.
For personal reasons, hell no.
Chris is UCI should be involved in gravel. Yes, no, or hell no.
I say yes.
Okay, yes.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the kind of gravel feels a little bit like mountain biking did in the 90s. And when you get that rainbow jersey, and it happened when there was mountain biking.
Sure.
And
yeah.
And I think it's
to say,
look,
that's true.
You're already seeing the growing pains of it.
Yeah.
It's like there's unspoken rules of gravel, but when somebody, you know, breaks the spirit of gravel, you know, it's like, it's kind of, if you're going to have that, you can't have, you know, all the resources that go into it and then not have, you know, the regulations and things that are, and the way of really recognizing it is the biggest governing body in international cycling recognizes it with a world championship.
No, Jesus.
It's true. It's true. It depresses me, but it's very, very true.
Yeah.
All right. This could potentially, these last two questions could be the most potential, damaging and serious questions of the entire sport of cycling. Second to last one, socks over leg warmers or under? Would Chris do socks over leg warmers or under his leg warmers?
Under.
Paul says under.
Is this even a...
This is a huge issue right now.
This is a real question.
This is filling social media right now. Jack, what do you say? Should socks go under or over leg warmers?
Severely under.
Severely under.
Who likes doing laundry?
Okay. All three of the panel says under. Chris Carmichael.
I don't even know why this is even a question.
I
don't think I've ever seen anybody ride with socks over leg warmers.
Good.
I've never.
What about socks over shoes? Socks over shoes.
Well,
so
Sean
under,
Kelly.
Yeah, yeah. I love socks.
Under. Chris.
He
said
have socks over shoes too.
If you're talking knickers, right? Knickers that the Brits sort of wear.
Yeah.
But that's different. I mean, you got to be British to do that. You're not going to get out there and ride with. Tell me you're not doing that, Pat, right?
No, hell no. No, I'm a hell no.
He's trying to make sure he's
that's
still cool.
That's what the young kids are doing now.
It's just become this gigantic issue with people on social media.
You wear white socks, or you're going to be in trouble.
Yeah, you're going to destroy your socks.
Bored people.
Yeah, exactly. So showing off your socks is for warm weather. If you're me and you actually get some color in your legs, that's when you wear the socks to show off, because most of the time my legs are just pasty white and they look like a dead fish. But you know, so there we go. Last of our rapid fire, what would Chris say? E-bikes in racing, yes, no, or hell no? What would Chris say, Paul Main?
In regular racing,
same category?
Their own category of racing, should e-bikes be raced? Paul Main.
I think he'll say fine as long as they're on their own.
He'll say yes. Yeah. Okay. Jack?
No.
Jack?
No.
Chris
no.
Carmichael will no. say no racing. Okay. Jackson?
I'll say yes.
Okay. Chris, should e-bikes be raced?
Oh, yeah. Why not?
Right on. If they got their own category, right? Yeah, just don't.
Yeah.
All right.
Don't bring them in the like,
over 70.
Peddling,
the over 70 group.
Don't bring them where somebody's peddling. Final points tally. Paul has 8. Jack Broadhead, you suck. You only have 4. Jackson Bulger, 7. Paul is the victorious. He can step inside the mind.
Well,
Chris
and I are only a year and a half apart, so I think I have a generation.
Next generation.
Yeah.
Well, Chris, first of all, thank you for your time, sir. You're like I said earlier, your insight into how the athletes should train and how the sport should be approached is a big part of the sport, and it's legendary. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Always good to chat with you. You guys are a lot of fun. Definitely enjoyed the talk.
Appreciate it. All right. Well, for all the listeners, again, you guys know how to find Chris. He mentioned his website. I honestly think that some of the books that have been written by Chris and by his colleagues have been an excellent foray into it. And then what you do is you read the book and you realize, like me, that you probably should take it to the next phase and talk to an actual human. And that's a great way to start. And obviously highly qualified coaches. And we live in a time that you get direct communication with these incredibly qualified coaches. So there we go. So get going, or you're just going to end up floundering like me for the rest of your life. And I'm going to leave the biggest thing I'm taking away is the bike is my church. I love that quote. Mm-hmm.
Awesome. You guys have a great Thanksgiving.
Hey, thanks. You too.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.